Hello and welcome again. Here we are with our Accented Philosophy Podcast. And my name is Andy.
Hi, I'm Gita.
And today we are talking about economics and philosophy. We are talking about Schumacher's classic book, Small is Beautiful, and the idea of Buddhist economics, and also about this idea of downscaling economics, perhaps, in order to make it more manageable and more human. So Ezekiel, do you want to begin?
Yeah, so it's kind of following the discussion we had last week, and this idea that maybe our way of thinking of economics is not the most effective, and it could also be harmful. And this book basically provides a few solutions for how we should shift our perspective, which is quite interesting because it was written in the 70s. So it was very revolutionary for the time. And some of these solutions, we could still make use of them today. I think one first thing could be to try to think of globalization in general, what the concept means, what are the potential advantages of globalization, and also the potential problems. So generally, if you advocate for globalization the way it is done right now, people come up with arguments like, well, globalization seems to be quite a good thing on paper, right? It means people can exchange more freedom, more possibility to develop, your business or whatever you're doing. Basically, you expand your horizon. And also people can move more freely. It's basically something that, helps us living in a more open and free world.
But we must perhaps also distinguish different types, because now you mentioned so many different things, right? The free movement of people is perhaps different from the movement of goods. And this, again, is perhaps different from the movement of information. So I'm thinking that what we are doing right now is a kind of using globalization to our advantage, because we are recording this in Hong Kong, right? And it goes out, and half of our listeners are from the United States, and others are perhaps in India or somewhere. And this, we can still reach them because of the globalization of information interchange. But it's, if you talk about the globalization of the movement of people and the globalization of work, this is a different thing. It's the point that the European Union is making, right? That you can go and work everywhere without needing visa and permissions. And then again, this seems different from the globalization of trade, which is an ancient thing. Already the ancient Greeks were importing all kinds of stuff from India and from Africa. And you had this Silk Road, which for a long time was a kind of globalization also, right? So do we have to distinguish these different types in order to judge correctly its dangers?
Yeah, we probably do. They're all pretty much the same in nature, I would say, but they're obviously different in the way they work, right? So, but the idea of globalization is basically to have a much more open world, whatever, that means, whether it is open economically, in terms of people, transportation, in terms of media, as you said. You could argue that this is just the natural order of things, that people naturally tend to travel, tend to want to exchange, tend to want to broaden the horizon in general. So I think this is, in fact, quite natural, though you could also say, well, people for most of human history have lived in small villages, never really left their country or even their region. But so both are true. There's also people who would always travel and try to, see what was going on the other side of the planet. So this is not necessarily a bad thing. This is my point.
Yeah, but you might even make a biological argument against this globalization in the sense that genetics and population genetics works much better if you keep populations separate, and then you have a limited exchange of genetic material between them. For example, what we are doing now with bananas, where essentially all bananas are the same banana genetically, has the problem that when you have a disease, you know, and then this disease affects one kind of banana, then we don't have any other bananas, and this is to that might be resistant to the disease, right? This is a problem with this agriculture at big scales, where internationally you have, you know, only a limited number of goods that sell well. And then whenever you have some problem that affects one crop, then it immediately becomes a global problem. Or with the bees, right? We talked about last time, right? We have the same problem. And the same, perhaps one might say, about human diseases. So as long as we had isolated populations, we had much less of this global incidence of diseases and pandemics, for example, like we have now with the COVID. That seems a thing that is directly related to globalization, right? If we had more borders, we wouldn't have this, perhaps, so much. Although, of course, when you think about it, in the Middle Ages, they had the plague. Although they had, you know, small countries and borders and so on, they still manage to have a global pandemic. So it's not immediately clear how this works, right?
Yeah. So usually the main argument for globalization is that, well, it is a natural thing, and it is, you know, movement is in general is inherently good for people. And then you have the argument that because of globalization, we have helped societies get out of poverty. It has generally raised the economic level, and it has eliminated or minimized a lot of the world's struggle. So there's less disease because we exchange drugs. There's less famines in general because we are able to exchange foods and means of growing foods, etc., etc. So that's the biggest argument for capitalism in general and globalization, is that it has helped people getting out of poverty. Then there's obviously a lot of problems that come with that. So as you said, there's things that would not have happened without globalization. And you're right to say that COVID has really questioned our ways of exchanging with each other. So COVID would have not happened just a few decades ago. And it is crazy when you think of how rapidly it has spread, which is directly linked to how rapidly we're able to move from one place to another, and how we no longer do this as something rare. We just constantly, go to the other side of the planet, which is not necessarily a bad thing once again, but it can potentially have some bad effects. And then about the question of poverty, you could also argue that even if there's generally less poverty in the world, the gap between the poor people and extremely rich people is much larger than it used to be. And then we can question whether this is a bad thing intrinsically. Maybe it's not, you know.
Can you explain this a little? Why would it not be a bad thing if we have this disparity in income between the rich and the poor?
So I'm not saying it's a good or a bad thing, but you could say, well, as long as everyone can satisfy basic needs like food and shelter and not being sick, well, it doesn't really matter if other people earn much, much more than them. Let's say if what they earn has not deprived others from, but that's another question. But you could also say that there is something wrong in this kind of inequality. It is wrong always that some people have much more than others.
This seems more plausible, right? Especially if you start with a Kantian perspective that, you know, we have to value every person the same and we have to treat everybody as ends. And then to say that I have some people who can barely survive and some people who have so much money that after their fifth villa, you know, they don't know what to do with it. This doesn't seem to be really treating everybody the same and treating everybody as ants. How would you justify this?
So I agree with you. It doesn't seem right. And maybe it doesn't seem right because of this conscious idea. Maybe we think we all have the same kind of value. So how come some are able to have that much more? You could, however, justify it if, well, the acquisition has been made without hurting anyone, without depriving anyone of anything. I know some people like Nozick, for example, would argue that, in fact, trying to promote as much equality as possible is not compatible with freedom. So the freedom of everyone to gather as many goods as they want. So he does think that there is an inherent conflict between equality and negative freedom, or the freedom to, you know, do as you please without being interfered with.
But so, we also have to ask, where do they gather this wealth, right? When you talk about gathering wealth, the question is, what are you using in order to get this wealth, and who owns these resources that you are exploiting? So it seems like very often it is not like somebody rightfully owns a field and then becomes rich by making a good use of his field. When you talk about the wealth of these big multinational companies, this often comes from exploiting tax loopholes. It comes from often selling products that are unhealthy or dangerous, and or by making use of natural resources that are free and should belong to everyone, but then they are monopolized or used up by this company in order to make profit. So it seems like a lot of these profits are not really justly belonging to this company, but they are obtained at the expense of the public sometimes, right?
Yes, this is true. So that's why everything is intertwined, and it's even more intertwined if we live in a globalized world, as we do. And also, on top of that, you could argue that all these resources are being used. I mean, we are using the Earth's resources and we are not able to replace them. It's not like we can create more. And so those resources are limited. And that's one of the points of the book, of Schumacher's book, the idea that our way of living, our Western capitalist way of living, is using, you know, Earth resources. And we'll have some day to realize that we can no longer live the way we live.
You know, one thing that I always found when you look at old histories and old biographies of the time of, let's say, Kant, or even a little earlier, Bach and these people, that they used to live in little kingdoms, in little places that were closed off against the rest of the world, and had their own ruler and their own king. And very often this was good for the development of different philosophies or even different kinds of music, because these kings were giving funds to develop, to keep these court musicians or court philosophers. They were funding academies. And when one of these philosophers said something that was not pleasing to this king, then he always had the choice of going to another king. And there are many examples of this, of philosophers who were not welcome in one part of Europe, and then they moved to some other part of Europe where the king liked them and supported them, and then they could continue doing their philosophy there in safety. And I'm not sure if this can be said to always be an advantage, but surely this compartmentalization has the advantage that you can have different value systems in different places, and this gives a diversity to opinions that we don't have today, right? Today we have this monoculture of ideas, which is particularly through the internet, you know, it's strengthened so that no place can really afford to have a very different opinion from another place, except perhaps, you know, North Korea or other countries that are mostly kept away from this. But in this global, you know, internet culture, we all have to have the same opinions like everybody else, and we have these trends that get global enforcement even by the public opinion. And it seems very difficult to steer against that. So is it true that globalization also somehow threatens the diversity of opinions, perhaps?
Yeah, in many ways it is. So you still have major cultural differences among countries. And I think we both know that, being Europeans living in Asia. Obviously, these will not disappear anytime soon. But generally, yeah, there is a kind of hegemony culturally. And even linguistically, you could argue, you know, English is just becoming the language everyone speaks, right? And it doesn't mean other languages will die. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but you know, it's also a bit of a pity that now you can rely on English only and travel everywhere in the world, and you don't have to, you know, you're never really forced to make an effort to, you know, adapt and learn a new language or whatever. And it's not necessarily a matter of linguistics only. It's also, you know, language shapes the way we think and the way we see the world. And if we speak a certain language that comes from a specific country, we will necessarily adopt their cultural lens a little bit, at least. So you could say it's a good thing because it encourages communication, obviously, but also maybe something is lost in that.
Right. So this is interesting, right? Because does it really encourage communication? If you imagine, let's say, you know, there is this thing that I don't know how true it is, that these people living in the north, you know, in close to the North Pole, they have many different words for snow, for example. And you can imagine somebody who lives in a North African desert might have many different words for different kinds of sand. And so when you say now that we bring these people together and we let them communicate in English, what happens is not really that they communicate their own experiences of snow and sand to each other, but it is that these experiences are not possible to communicate. And by switching to English, they just exclude these experiences from their communication. And they can only communicate about what is the common basic stock of things they can communicate about in English. But all the nuance and all the richness of communication is actually lost the moment they speak in English, because they can only say snow and sand and nothing else.
Yeah, this is true. You also become a little bit of a different person when you speak another language. So you're still you, obviously, but I don't feel like I'm acting or talking or behaving exactly the same if I speak English or if I speak in my native language. Because also I know who I'm talking to. And if I speak my native language to other people who speak that language, I know I will behave in a certain way that I know they will understand and we will be able to relate to each other. And when I speak English, because I know people around me are from different backgrounds, we kind of like all adopt this same kind of generic cultural behavior, which is centered around English. As you said, it's a very limiting experience. And it's very hard to switch from one to another. And it's hard to get an aspect of one and present it to the other sphere. So, well, now it's a question of language, and we could go on and on about that. But there's definitely something that's lost.
Right. And one more thing about that. In Greek, I don't know, other languages don't seem to have it, or many other newer languages don't seem to have it that much. Perhaps other ancient languages have it. In Greek, you have this a thing where all these different versions of Greek that were used throughout the centuries, throughout the millennia, you have to say, that leave traces in the language. And today you can very often sense the political position of someone who speaks to you by his choice of words. So more conservative people tend to use more ancient words or ancient roots or ancient grammar in their speech than communists who have, you know, a very much different dialect of Greek, really, which is much more modern and uses also different grammatical forms and often different vocabulary. I don't know, can you do this in French, that you hear the speech of someone and you can identify their political position? And this, of course, is totally lost when you speak English, right?
Yeah. That's very interesting. I don't think we can quite do that. We can figure maybe where they're from, if they belong to a certain, you know, class, or what their social status generally is, what their age is. So there's a few things like that, but I don't think you could quite determine what, you know, party they vote for. Some words, some little things would give you a clear indication that maybe they're likely to be religious or they're likely to be conservatives, but it's quite subtle. And you would really need to be French and know the culture quite well to be able to tell. So that's very interesting what you just said.
So one other aspect is, of course, globalization. And these big countries make bad governments more dangerous, right? This is another thing. When you have small countries and you have, you know, some crazy dictator in a small country, like, say, you know, in Greece, we had a dictatorship for 7 years at the beginning of the 70s. And these were dangerous people. They were crazy people, but they were limited to this small country. So they were not a global threat. But yeah. Then when you have these big countries, for example, Trump was able to inflict a lot more damage than the Greek dictator was in the 70s, just because his country is so big and powerful and they have all these means of inflicting damage on others, right? So and the same you could say of other countries today, right? So the bigger the countries become, the more a bad government becomes able to become a danger to others worldwide. And so this also seems perhaps to speak against globalization or against letting countries grow so big.
I think it does. But then you could also have the opposite argument, which is, well, because some countries are that powerful, we need, you know, to unionize and create things like NATO, for example, so that we can counterbalance the power of this other powerful country. But so, yeah, it's true that globalization may create these, you know, monster countries that are able to dominate others. But at the same time, globalization also makes it possible for other countries to get together and also be powerful. And so if these are good, let's say, I mean, how do we define good in this context? It's pretty hard, but at least it's some kind of power that can work against the power of a bad government. So without globalization, that would not be possible.
Where I lived in Germany, this was a place called Göttingen, and it was very close to the city of Hanover. And historically, these two cities, which are only 1 hour apart with a car or the train, belonged to different kingdoms. And there was one, actually, a war between them, in which 3,000 young people died, you know, soldiers, in a fight between Göttingen and Hanover. And today this is totally silly to think of it, right? These are neighboring cities and they are, you know, you live in the one and sleep in the other and so on. And they are both German cities and perfectly peaceful. And so sometimes, you know, it also, this could be an argument in favor of globalization. Like you say that, if we have all these little kingdoms, then of course we increase the probability that these kingdoms will be at war with each other. They will compete for resources, while bigger countries might be able to organize things more peacefully, or even bigger, like you say, you know, conglomerates of countries.
Yeah, that was one of the first arguments for the European Union. You know, like today would be it's very odd to think of these countries being at war with each other, and they were just some decades ago. So, but yeah, the European Union was this idea that, well, if we stick together and we create this big union of countries, we'll be more powerful and we will not be at war with each other. And it worked to some extent. So,
it did work, right? Exactly. So one thing about the economy, now back to Schumacher, he says that this idea that globalization helps the poorer countries is perhaps wrong, And he provides one example that I found very interesting in the book. He talks about the egg trays in African country. I don't remember exactly which one it was. Somewhere in Africa, you have a place where they produce eggs, and they're in a village, and they want to bring these eggs to the city to sell them. But this was not possible. So these eggs in the end had to be thrown away because they didn't have enough trays to distribute the eggs into the city. And it turns out that these trays in the 70s, when this was written, there was also a documentary made, which is on YouTube. You can also find it there. When this happened in the 70s, there was obviously only one company worldwide that made egg trays, because it's such a specialized thing. And these can be produced best at big scale. So you have a factory that costs, you know, millions and produces millions of trays. But then, of course, these don't want to sell trays to one little place, one little village in Africa. They only do orders of millions of trays. And so if you are this African producer of eggs, then you don't have access to trays. And then you cannot package your eggs and you cannot deliver them anywhere because you don't have this packaging. And nobody can produce this packaging because this is just one very expensive factory making it. So this seems to be a problem with this idea that the globalization can benefit small or poorer places, because it seems that globalization is also always focused on the big scale of things. And if small places have small problems that fall under this big scale, then these problems don't get addressed.
Yeah, this is true. And it's a good example. Though then you could also say that with globalization, you would have, it is likely that you would have more companies that produce these trades. So globalization also works against, monopoles. So monopolizing egg trays is bad because then this one company tends to grow and focus on the larger scale of things. And then the little guys are forgotten. But if you have the freedom to create multiple companies, and then you have less and less regulations, well, then you have a company for everyone. Right? Some smaller companies will provide some trades to, you know, these smaller countries. And you could think this is a good thing. So everyone gets what they can get. But usually, monopoly is associated with, you know, strong government, right? If you have a very socialist country, usually you'd have one company that provides this service. And this is not the idea of globalization. It's quite the opposite, in fact.
The idea, yes, but is the reality like that? Yeah. I mean, it seems that this free market idea is not always the free market reality. So if you look at Amazon, for example, Amazon has taken over a big part of global trade. And they have closed down many other bookshops primarily in the beginning, but now also, you know, all these shops in the inner cities, what in English you call the high street, you know, these shops are closing because people can order everything they want from Amazon and they don't need to go out of the house. And so Amazon profits from closing down their competitors' businesses. And it doesn't seem that it is possible to compete with Amazon in any real way by opening your own little web shop, right? This is not going to happen. So can we actually say that this really is the case, what you just said, that this kind of competition would benefit everyone and especially allow small companies to come forward?
No, it's not. And so that's why globalization is sneaky. Because it tells you that it is possible. Well, you're free to create your business. You're free to, you know, provide egg trays to anyone you want. But in reality, this is impossible because you cannot compete with the big guys. So as you said, it's one thing for something to be possible in a possible world and then to be actually a possibility in this world. So yeah, I agree with you. This is not practically possible. It's not the reality. There is a big gap between the reality and what globalization wants to promote.
Right. And another example is our media landscape, right? Where we have all these book publishers being bought up by each other, or the big media companies, you know, Disney and 20th Century Fox and all these buying each other out, so that in the end you end up with only, you know, two or three big media companies that own global media. And there it is. I don't know how much it is consolation that we have YouTube. I mean, we do have YouTube, and we can do this kind of thing here with our, you know, 100 viewers. But can we really compete against these big companies? And do we now have more diversity in media than we heard, than we had, you know, 50 years ago, when the world was full of small newspapers, and we didn't have YouTube, but we also didn't have Disney to that extent that we have it today?
Yeah, so I don't know. I also don't want to say things like it was a bit better before. And so, because I don't really know about, we have a multitude of voices. When you talk about the media, sure, you have these big guys, and yeah, you can, it's a handful of people really. But then you do have a multitude of little things, and things that YouTube and the internet in general have provided a platform for all these little voices. That would not have been able to express themselves before. Before, when you talk, I don't know, maybe you had a couple newspapers for, you know, a state, and they would most likely say what the government wanted them to say. I don't know if there was much freedom of the press. I don't know if there was, and even without talking about freedom of the press, the people had no voice. It was impossible to just, or you just had to, you know, go to the market of your little town and yell something, you know, for you to be heard. Like, there was no platform, and the internet has provided this. So in a way, sure, you have the big guys, but you always had bigger guys. But now at least you have this multitude of people who can say things in different ways.
Right. They can say things, but they cannot be heard. Right. So it's a problem of exposure, right? Somehow shifted. So you can now put your opinion out there, but it is there together with the opinions of billions of other people who are all the same, and there is no structure, and there is no way to get more exposure, so that everybody's voice is just drowned in this echoing chamber of voices. And then there is the question, does it really improve anything? Is this really effective in putting your voice out there if everybody else is shouting at the same volume like you do?
So it may not be very effective, but you do, I don't know if this is true, that we're all drawn in this ocean of voices. Some people actually are able to be heard. I don't really know what it takes, but you know, you can, maybe you wake up one day, you went viral overnight, and now everyone's listening to you, and you don't exactly know what happened. But this is how the internet works. And sometimes it's for stupid little things, and sometimes it's for important things. So I do think that the internet, maybe I'm being too naive, and maybe it's a generational thing. I don't know. I tend to really like the internet in general. And I do think it gives people a chance to have their ideas heard, in fact. And also, it's not a place that's very regulated yet. It is in some countries, and in some ways it is very regulated, but still, you still have quite a lot of freedom on the internet that you would not have in like traditional newspapers or TV or the radio.
Okay, yeah, so this perhaps brings us to, you know, plug our website, dailyphilosophy.com, where you can find a lot of philosophy if you like this kind of thing, and you can hear our little voice that is hopefully not completely drowned by all the other voices. So feel free to go there and have a look if you're interested in philosophy. Okay, so now back to Schumacher. So Schumacher has this thing where he talks a lot about, because he's an economist, right? And he's also an economist, particularly of energy. So he started by being on the coal board in England, and he was making predictions about how energy markets will develop in the future and coal. And then he worked in what was then called Burma, what today is Myanmar, for many years. And there he also saw Buddhism and Buddhist monasteries, and then was inspired to create this Buddhist economics as an alternative model to what happened in the West. And he says that one problem with this Western development help, he describes, he saw a case in India where there was in a rural place, somebody had put a very expensive machine with Western money, Western, you know, development help, and workers were trained to operate this machine. And then he asked them, so what will happen when you finish being trained on this machine? Will you find work here in your village? And they said, of course not, because this machine does not exist in this village. This is the only, you know, it costs millions. This is the only type of this type of machine here. And this is only used for us to train on. So we cannot work with this knowledge in this village. So what will you do then? And they say, we will go to the city and there we will try to find work. And then Schumacher concludes that this is the totally wrong way of giving help to these countries, because what you are doing is to actually make the situation worse. So these workers will have to go to the big city where they will be, again, unemployed, and they will contribute to the growth of the city and the death of the countryside. They will take away their productive work from the countryside where they could actually be doing something useful and for them, you know, satisfying. And instead, they go to a city where they're going to live in a slum, perhaps, and be unemployed. And so this whole thing of training them on this machine has not really improved their situation at all. And so he takes this to start his criticism of globalization, of going away from the country towards the big cities. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think he's quite right that developmental aid, if we decided it's a good thing, because you could also question that. You could also question the idea that we should, as Western countries, go and help poorer countries by giving them money and instead of maybe teaching them new skills or things like that. But that's a different debate. But if there is such a thing as good developmental aid, it should be focused on the rural areas. And I think it makes a lot of sense, because obviously then you develop the rural areas, which are, you know, what people actually need, because this is where you actually grow food and produce the things that people then will need. And, the exponential growth of cities is not necessarily a good thing. Cities, you know, have a lot of people. It's hard for everyone to get a job. They also, you know, contribute to, obviously, pollution and all of that.
And we tend to forget that the only places that actually produce something is the countryside, right? It's the only places where something is created out of nothing with the energy of the sun and the input of water and fertilizer. You create something that wasn't there before. Whatever we create in cities is just moving resources around and exchanging them and trading them, but it is not making anything new. I think this is one of his points, right? With how, why we should emphasize the value of the countryside.
Yeah, and these are, you know, not only this is where you produce the, you know, the things, but also it's the things we actually need, the most essential things for our well-being. And also there is a thing to be said about our way of living. You know, it's a very different thing to live in the country and to live in a city. In a city, you tend to be more alone, more, you know, it's more of an individualistic life. In the country, you live in a village, you live with a family. Like, traditionally, this is how people have lived. And you could say, well, maybe this is how we're supposed to live. This idea of hyper-individualism, I think, I read something about this. I'm not sure where it came from, but the author was arguing that it comes from, you know, people leaving the country to find work in the cities. And you have all these young men who, you know, don't have the structure they used to have. And they end up in a dormitory with a bunch of men like themselves, all working the same jobs, factory jobs, all doing the same things and all looking the same and having the same hopes. And then, well, you feel a bit lost. You feel like who are you? Are you much different from them? And from that, you could say that the idea of wanting to build your individuality, you know, it becomes an obsession. You need to be different from others. And then you need to figure out, who am I really? But that's quite a new idea for mankind. It used to be much different. It was not who am I, what are my desires, but it's like, how can I be helpful to, you know, the community? How am I being a good, you know, whatever, like son or farmer or brother or husband or whatever?
Yeah, mainly because you didn't have a choice, right? I mean, we should not over-idealize it. So you didn't, if you were the son of a shoemaker, you became a shoemaker not because you like shoes, but because you didn't have a choice about it, right?
No, you didn't have a choice. But maybe this is how, I don't know if people flourish more one way or another, but maybe they do. Maybe it's the most natural way for people to live, and maybe the most natural way is the best way. Not always, obviously. But you could wonder if this way of living in big cities has contributed to well-being or not. Maybe it has not. And hence the you know, importance of developing rural areas so that people can actually do what they're supposed to be doing in the most informed way.
But now, in order to avoid, you know, being accused of being, you know, hypocrites in some way, I mean, both of us are now in a big city, which is not our place. We relocated here because we wanted a big city, and we both come from more rural places. I lived in rural Germany. You lived for a while, I think, in Africa, right? And you said that you left this place because it was too rural, so it didn't satisfy you with the life you wanted to have, and then you came to this big city to have a better life. So the question is, are we now asking something other people to do which we ourselves wouldn't be prepared to do?
No, I am a pure product of globalization, and I've traveled a lot, and I've lived in different places. I tend to like cities a lot. I enjoy this life. I'm very far from my family, like from my community. I'm talking about this from the inside, really. And I'm not judging people who have the same kind of lifestyle. I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing. I'm just questioning whether it is what brings the most well-being in general on the larger scale. I'm very aware that my way of living is contributing to all the worst problems, especially regarding the environment. You know, I fly a lot. I used to before COVID. So I participate in this big, in this capitalist way of living that ultimately will probably destroy all of us. But so I'm not saying we should change everything right now. I would not be willing to. But we can, you know, question whether we want the world to keep going that direction. I think, and
it seems like there are different kinds of movement of labor, right? So we have to perhaps distinguish even more, and this didn't exist in Schumacher's time, this is today's thing, that, of course, we have these medieval shoemakers who then in the city had the opportunity to perhaps become something different and change their traditional occupation. Then we have these workers in India who go from the countryside to the cities in order to find work. But we, and these support Schumacher's point, but perhaps we also see today this global nomad worker movement, where you have these young people who are very highly qualified programmers, media people, or perhaps like us, you know, public educators in some way. And they voluntarily choose this nomadic lifestyle. And there are even, you know, there has recently been a movie about this. There are many, YouTube is full of nomad workers, global nomads, right, who take their car sometimes or just a plane ticket and move to a place that is cheap, you know, move to Thailand or move to India or some other place where with US income, you can live in a very high standard of living, and then they enjoy their days, you know, on the beach or in the jungle, and producing, you know, content for, let's say, YouTube, or producing an app, programming something, developing software, which brings them the income that they need in order to have this lifestyle. So this is a lifestyle that is interestingly, you know, not being inside the standard Western structures of work. It is a nomadic lifestyle, but at the same time, it seems to be a lifestyle that goes only together with globalization. It is against this idea of becoming more rural and more rooted in decentralized work, although it is decentralized in a way, right? But it is decentralized on top of globalization, not by rejecting globalization. Yeah, how can we make sense of this?
Yeah, it is quite a paradox, isn't it? I think it's a very attractive lifestyle, but I think we need to make sure that it does not disturb the life of, you know, local people who live a certain way, a very different way, in their country of origin. So I'm always afraid that this will just continue to create a gap and just broaden the gap between, you know, people who come from developed countries and those who don't. And the idea that these people might take advantage of what poorer countries may have to offer without really contributing so much. So this is what I would be a bit cautious of, though I agree that this is a lifestyle that, you know, most people want to live, and I would not be unhappy. I would not be unhappy if I lived that lifestyle myself, which I do. I mean, I've been living far from my home country for a long time. I've been moving to different countries. So
okay, but one must say that we are still embedded into a traditional working structure at this time, at least, right? I mean, we are employees, we get a salary from this country where we are, and we pay taxes. So we are not doing exactly the thing that I was just talking about with these nomads who live out of a truck, right, out of a van, and live by getting YouTube income. So this is still more radical, right? Departure.
Yeah, this is, we were a bit in the middle, I would say. But yeah, it's a different lifestyle. Right. So yeah, I think it needs to just be done respectfully of the people who have always lived in that specific country, so that it does not continue to, you know, this pattern of using resources and not contributing in return.
Exactly. Okay, so this brings us to the meaning of work, perhaps, because one of the reasons why these nomad workers do this is that they say, you know, this gives them the opportunity to do meaningful work, work that is personally meaningful to them, rather than work that is, as Marx would perhaps say, alienated, where the worker does not have any connection to his work. And this is also an important point in Schumacher's criticism of work. So the point of this Buddhist economics, as he calls it, is that we reconsider what work is really about. And in this Western model, we think that work is about earning money and then consuming more. And a more successful life is a life in which you consume more, right? This is essentially how we see it. Whoever has more money to spend and actually spends this money has a better life, we would say, right? He has five cars, he has five televisions, he has a better life than somebody with only a bicycle and no television. But now Schumacher criticizes this. He says, you know, the function of work should primarily be in a Buddhist, as he calls it, Buddhist sense. I'm a little, you know, unclear how much of that is actually Buddhist, but let's take his way of saying it, right? He says we should give men chances to develop and utilize their faculties and enable them to overcome their ego-centeredness by working with others on a common task. And the third function is to create goods and services needed for a becoming existence. So the becoming existence is the last point. Yes, work creates, you know, these goods and services, and so it is valuable materially. But also there are two other things which our Western economies don't consider, which is that work gives us the chance to develop our faculties, and also collaborative work with others gives us the social skills, and it gives us this social environment in which we can perform and develop ourselves. And now it seems that modern economy in the West does, and modern work, right, structures of work don't honor this sufficiently, right? They don't promote these goals. And especially with the pandemic now that everything has become virtual and over Zoom, this second point of work giving you the social environment has dissolved even further, right? Yeah,
definitely. So this is very interesting. The question of work and the value of work is fascinating. There is a difference, obviously, between work and employment, right? So we all work all the time, even someone who's unemployed, unless this stay at home and do nothing all day, which is very unlikely. They work. We work on different things. We read, we learn things. This is, can be considered work. And this is important. We need to do that. And I think this is his point, that people will always need work. But this is very different from being employed and doing a task so that then you receive money, so then that you can pay your rent and all of that. The problem with work is that it has been, you know, industrialized, and then it became what it is today. And it's, you know, as you said, it's a form of alienation if you simply do a certain task because you need something. You need it to satisfy your basic interests, right? So there is no question of choosing what you want to do. There is no question. Also, time you may feel is being taken away from you. And I think his point is that, well, it's very, this is why I like the idea of, you know, universal basic income, which is, you know, something that people have talked about as a solution to this problem between, of the distance between one's meaning in life and the work they're doing. You know, the fact that people don't really find any meaning in their work. You now have all these talks about, you know, bullshit jobs, this kind of jobs that you don't really know what they're good for. You don't really know what they are. Even the people who work them sometimes are not sure what they're doing. But just to be clear, what I meant by bullshit jobs is like office jobs that are usually very high paid and don't contribute a ton to society. In fact, it's quite unclear what the people doing these are doing and how they're helping others. But everything that has to do with community work or, you know, doing something that's meaningful, that you can actually describe and you can tell how you're contributing to society, that doesn't count as a bullshit job. But I agree, there's some jobs that are less attractive than others. And if you have universal basic income, well, maybe no one will want to do these, but we need them. I think that, well, then it's not really philosophical, but like if we talk economics, the idea of this universal income is that it's not high enough for people not to want to work more. So it should cover your basic needs, but still not really allow you to do much more so that you will want to get a job. And if, you know, like right now, if you're not very qualified, well, you'll get one of these jobs. And so you'll get extra money. But you don't have, for example, to work as many hours as you typically would. And that means there's more jobs for more people. And you're not alienated by your need to work 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week. You can also then try to contribute in a different way and try to do something that does bring meaning to your life, even if you have this part-time job that is just cleaning the street. And then if you're more qualified, well, you do other jobs that you may, you know, maybe you become a doctor or whatever you want to do. Or you can have incentives, you know, you can pay these jobs really well. You can think of different ways to make them more attractive. But the idea is, so most people who oppose this kind of income will say people will just be lazy and do nothing all day. I don't think that's realistic. I think people do want to work. It's very natural for us to want to create things and be helpful.
Right. But I think that perhaps also there's a problem in connecting meaning and work in this way. And perhaps Schumacher is also guilty of doing this a little too much, because we always imagine then in this utopia of good, meaningful work, that work is about, you know, giving your life meaning. And if you are, you know, an artisan shoemaker or an artisan, you know, philosopher or an artisan, you know, whatever, you have this satisfaction in your life and this meaning from creating the whole product. This is also something Marx says in this concept of alienation, right? But In reality, perhaps these utopias don't sufficiently consider that many jobs are not like that, but they still need to be done. So many jobs are not that attractive, but still somebody needs to do them. So again, the cleaning of the streets, right, is not something anybody really wants to do or would take pride in. I mean, perhaps you can imagine if you have a particularly difficult stretch of the road and then you manage to, but it's not generally something that would cause you to have a big sense of achievement, but somebody still needs to do that. So how do we deal with that? And there are many such jobs, right? So also all these insurance jobs and banking jobs and all these jobs that somebody needs to do, although they don't really provide this emotional satisfaction.
I don't know, maybe this is a bit radical, but you could have a turning system, maybe. You could say, well, each week, an amount of people will have to clean the street, and then they will have to do other things. Like, it could just be a short amount of time during your week, because if you have another job, or if you have this universal income, your needs are covered. You would still get paid for that, but you could imagine a world where every citizen has to, as a part of civil duty, contribute in this way. So we would all have to do it, or maybe one day a week you need to clean the street. I don't see how that, it would obviously would mean that we all rethink of the ways we choose our jobs and we think of society. But I don't see it as, I think it could actually be a very good idea. You had military service back in the days and everyone had to do its part. And it's still the case in many countries, like Israel, for example. And you could have this as a kind of civic service and just help the community. And you would have to do this for your entire life until you retire. Why not?
Right. So perhaps this would be a solution to that, right? Although it doesn't sound very attractive, right?
But perhaps it's the only way. I don't think people would be very happy if a politician came up with this idea right now. I don't think they would. But you could imagine this as a solution,
It's certainly fairer, to share the unattractive jobs than just to have people like today, who are forced to do them all their lives. So from a justice perspective, it seems really better to share them, although most of us who don't have such jobs would not like the idea of having to do them. Okay, so perhaps the last thing that we need to talk about, there's much more in Schumacher than we managed to talk about today. He talks about renewable energy a lot, non-renewable energy. But these things are a little dated, right? Because they were written in the 70s, so Schumacher didn't know about... he knew about nuclear power, which he was very afraid of for the right reasons. But he didn't know, for example, about all the solar developments that we nowadays have. And but particularly these successes of renewable energies that now become competitive and sometimes even cheaper than traditional oil. He also seems to have underestimated or overestimated the depletion of oil reserves. He had the prediction that we would have long run out of oil. But obviously our oil companies keep finding oil or finding more harmful ways of producing oil, like the fracking that they're doing. And so we seem to still get by being able to cheat our way through this energy crisis. But let us briefly also at the end of this perhaps talk about the appropriate size of a city or country. This is something that is perhaps also a little surprising, that Schumacher emphasizes that in order to have a working, well-working, system, we should stop this movement from the countryside to the city, and we should stop these mega cities from developing. And we already have many such mega cities. London has 20 million, right? Many places all over the world, and particularly in China, you have cities of 30 or 40 million people in one city. And so the thing is, that he thinks that this is not healthy. We already talked about it, right? Cities don't produce resources, they consume them. There are places where ecologically there is a lot of burden on the environment. And so we should abandon this and limit the size of cities to, he says specifically, 500,000 inhabitants as a maximum. Mm-hmm. And now what do we make of this? Is this a good idea? Is this even possible? What would be the benefits of this? And should we do it?
I think small countries are generally a good idea. Because the smaller the country, obviously, the closer the government is to its people and its people's needs. It's easy to identify your own needs when you know, all mixed together in this. Think of a country like the size of the United States. It's so diverse, it's so big, different climates, different things to do. So different interests for everyone. And how can the government keep up with this? In fact, it doesn't, because it's a federal country and each state is, managing things. But then you still have a government, and that's what people feel very distant from the government. Maybe the bigger the country, the more likely you end up feeling like your representatives can't really see you and they don't know what you need. So from that perspective, I think going as much local as we can is generally the solution. And that means smaller countries, and that may mean, doesn't mean, that we should close borders more than we do. That I'm not sure. I do like the idea of open borders. My sympathy goes in that direction. But I also see that it can be a threat, as we said. And some kind of protectionism is not necessarily bad, as long as it means respecting the needs of people and also the planet. Because we have not talked a lot about the environmental cost of globalization, though we have a little bit, but like basically, if we have smaller countries, these countries will be less likely to be big powers that impose their wills on everyone and then contribute to global warming as much as bigger countries do. And I do think that this is a good thing in general, though it's not a very popular idea right now. The mainstream idea is that we need to open borders and we need to be bigger and bigger. And if we're not big, at least we need to get together to form like this kind of NATO alliance or the European Union in general, because we need to compete with the bigger countries. As much as I like the idea of, being friends with other countries, I also think people need different things. And we don't, hegemony is not necessarily good. It's also not good for people's, our sovereignty as, citizens of democratic countries.
Yeah, so the problem gets more complicated now with sovereignty and the power of countries, because you have these multinational corporations and now you have to also find a solution for those. So if you have smaller countries, then relatively the power of a multinational corporation grows because the possibility of regulating it is not there for a small country. And this, we see this today with Google and Facebook, where countries try to, like Australia recently had a problem with Google and Facebook about the news, and they try to legislate against Facebook and Google, and then Google and Facebook threatened to go out of the country. And then in the end, somehow the thing was patched over. But the fundamental problem is there. If Google says, we take Google search away from your country, then your country is finished, also in an economical sense, right? You cannot have an economy thriving without Google Docs and without Google Maps and without Google search. So, and the smaller the country is, the less it is able to provide its own alternatives. You could imagine that Russia or China, and they have done it, right, can exist without Google because they are able to provide alternatives for this functionality, because these countries are big enough to develop their own alternatives. But Denmark or Belgium cannot provide a Belgian or Danish search engine and maps and operating system for phones. And so therefore they will be left out if these big multinational corporations threaten them. And so this is a problem, right? How can small countries then legislate against these big multinational corporations? Is this an argument towards globalization again, in favor of globalization?
No, I think we should treat corporations as countries, states, or even agents. And we should impose regulations on them much more than we do. I do think this is possible. I think the fact that they are unregulated like that and therefore have all this power is due to states' unwillingness to regulate them, to impose, different regulations, the kind of regulations they would impose on companies, medium-sized, small-sized companies within their borders. So I don't think it's an argument for more globalization. I think it's an argument for more local, for just more power to governments in general, so that they would treat corporations the way they treat agents. But
this then requires cooperation between the governments, right? If Denmark cannot go off and regulate by itself against Google, right? This wouldn't work because Google can always threaten to take the services away from them.
Yeah, so that is obviously, it takes all governments or close to all governments to make the same decision. So,
But then you end up again with the European Union, right? You end up with a global union of governments that take the same decisions, right? Isn't it? I mean, you're again...
That all governments independently would take that decision. I'm not against the idea of governments coming together and deciding of some things. For example, that could be a reason. So cooperation regulations could be a reason countries could get together and take decisions. Then when it comes to the need of the people in their countries, I don't know if people as sovereign, because they're citizens of democratic countries, should be subjected to regulations that come from a big group of countries. But this is a very difficult question. And, countries, states sometimes agree, but also, they very rarely do. In fact, it's quite incredible that I think very recently, like last week, European Union, every country except Ireland decided that there would be a tax of 15% on corporations, like Google and Facebook and these big guys. But this is, I think, the first time that almost all of them agreed on this. So maybe it is a good thing that they come together for some of these decisions, but not when it comes to more local problems. We can divide our attention, right? We can decide that some things are worth, coming together and others are not.
So then let's finish it here now. And next week we will talk more about this and perhaps also with a little more focus on different technologies and how technologies influence our lives and how this relates also again back to what Chomaka is saying. So thank you and see you again next week.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.